The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Almost 2 weeks into 2017, there have been 1,322 gun-related incidents in the United States and 342 deaths. That's according to the Gun Violence Archive. For most people who sustain traumatic injuries from bullets or from car crashes, death occurs within an hour. A trial at one of the country's leading trauma centers aims to keep victims alive longer using profound hypothermia, basically freezing circulation of critically wounded victims when every second counts. The experiment at Baltimore's Shock Trauma Center has been called blasphemy by some in the medical field and raises questions of consent, ethics, and racism in a country with a sordid history of medical experiments on African Americans. Nicola Twilley is co-host of the Gastropod podcast, and she's a contributing writer for The New Yorker, where she reported on this story. And Nicola, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So this process, it's called Emergency Preservation and Resuscitation, or EPR. How does it work?
When someone comes into the emergency room with a gunshot wound and their heart stops, and the medics open the chest at that point, typically they have this sort of device that it looks like a medieval torture instrument, and they spread the ribs and get in there to the heart. Normally, at that point, they would start massaging the heart to try and get it going again and keep the person alive. Instead, with EPR, emergency preservation and resuscitation, what they're going to do is put in a cannula and start pumping that person full of ice-cold saline solution. And in 20 minutes, they're aiming to get their body temperature down to 50 degrees, which when you think about healthy temperatures, sort of between 97 and 99 degrees Fahrenheit, that's really cold. 50 degrees is profound hypothermia. And they're pumping all the blood out of the body, so there will be no blood left in this person, just ice-cold saline.
So they will have no blood, no pulse, and no brain activity. What is the risk of brain damage from a procedure like this?
That's actually sort of the point of the procedure, is to avoid brain damage. So the idea is, you know, if your brain stops receiving enough oxygen in blood, you have about 5 minutes before it starts to be damaged and starts to die, basically. And so that's really the problem with gunshot victims, is they're losing blood so fast that often the brain damage will set in before surgeons can sew them up and deal with the other holes that are letting all the blood out. So EPR, the idea is, it sort of works like a fridge. It slows things down. When things are in the cold, metabolism is slower, and the idea is your brain will just need less oxygen at this very, very cold temperature. And so it won't be sort of gasping for oxygen and dying off because it doesn't have enough oxygen. The cold will actually be preserving it so that the surgeons can find out where the bullet holes are, stitch them up, and then gradually reheat you and, you know, start circulating blood again, bring you up to temperature. And the idea is your brain will be intact.
Well, this procedure, the idea of cooling patients until you can treat them, has been, and you point out in the article, been called blasphemy by some in the medical field. So what is the opposition?
Well, so surgeons, as a general rule, think of hypothermia in their, you know, in their trauma patients as a really, really bad thing. It's actually part of the triad of death, which sounds super ominous, but there are three sort of things that happen to a trauma patient. They get cold, the pH level in their blood plasma drops, and then their blood stops coagulating, stops kind of forming clots. And all of those three sort of feed into each other, and it's a sort of a death spiral for trauma patients. So it's dogma on the trauma ward that if a patient starts getting cold, they're going to die. and that you should do everything you can to keep them warm. So for surgeons, this is sort of a counterintuitive idea in a lot of ways.
So you spoke to and followed around, it looks like, the director of the EPR trial, Sam Tischerman. He's a professor of surgery at the University of Maryland, which is the teaching hospital where the shock trauma unit is centered. What gave him this idea, and is it working?
So, I mean, Sam Tischerman is a guy who has spent his entire career working on this idea, and it really stems from a frustration that he had as a very junior doctor in his early days, seeing young, perfectly healthy men come in with gunshot wounds that were perfectly fixable if only you had more time. And he's just been obsessed with this idea of sort of buying them time ever since. This trial has taken something like 30 years to get going. And so in terms of doing the research around it and developing the techniques and then getting the approvals and the funding and so on like that. So he's been working on it for a long time. Doctors have been experimenting with cooling for a while. There was a Canadian surgeon, Wilfred Bigelow, who discovered in the 50s that if you anesthetized dogs and then lowered their temperature, they needed less oxygen to survive. For every degree that you sort of dropped their temperature, they needed a certain percentage less oxygen. And early heart surgeons used that information to do the first open heart surgery. They just kind of put the little girl in refrigerated blankets and just bought a little extra time to stop her heart and fix it.
And how about the trials now to date? Has Sam and his team been able to save patients before bleeding out?
I know, isn't that the question? So I'm dying to know that too. The trial finally got started this fall, at October, November time. For the first 10 patients that they try it on, they're not going to release results until they have done those 10 patients, until the trial is complete. Probably it has. Probably they've seen some candidates in Baltimore and they have tried it. Has it worked? I don't know, and they won't say.
I'm speaking with Nicola Twilley. She's co-host of the podcast Gastropod. She's also a contributing writer for The New Yorker, where she wrote about trials at a Baltimore trauma center experimenting with using hypothermia to save gunshot victims. Well, in addition to the skepticism in the medical community, there is this ethical question here of consent. Patients will be incapable of giving consent if they're clinically dead. So what is the protocol in cases like this?
This is a known problem with trauma research in general. The FDA has a way of handling this because people who have been severely injured are very rarely in a position to give their consent, and their family are probably not standing there ready to give it either. And you don't have time to find the family frequently. So the FDA sort of allows a sort of specific exception for what's called waived consent trials, where consent is not possible. And what you typically have to do to be allowed to do one of these waived consent trials is you have to do a community consultation process. So you have to show the FDA and your hospital review board and all of these sorts of governing bodies that try to make sure that clinical trials are ethical. You have to show them that you have made an effort to let as many of the people who might be affected by this trial know about it, share their concerns, have a way to opt out. So in Baltimore, you could opt out of this trial. You still can, as it happens. All you have to do is sort of say, I want to opt out on the website or give a call, and they will send you a little rubber bracelet. It's a red rubber bracelet, like sort of like those Lance Armstrong, Livestrong ones. And you wear it, and it says no to EPR. And that way, if you are shot and you are brought into shock trauma, they will know that you have said no. Of course, the community consultation process, and I sat in on this. I went to, you know, sort of setting up shop at a mall and handing out leaflets and things like that. It's limited in who it can reach. I mean, people are busy. Are they going to stop and listen to someone trying to explain to them this complex medical procedure that they don't think will ever apply to them? Probably not. So it's not a perfect solution. It's a long way from what you would call informed consent, but that's that's the sort of compromise that the FDA recommends.
And this, of course, is a city where 90% of the victims of gunshot wounds are black men under 30, and a country where black people with gunshot injuries are more than twice as likely to die as whites. I found all of this in your article. But also the backdrop of American history and mistrust of the medical community. If you could run us through some of the points of that history that has made African Americans so mistrustful of medical experimentation.
Right. And this is something that I think if you're not African American, you might not know. But it's a shocking history of medical experimentation and mistreatment applied by the medical establishment to black people. So, I mean, what the most sort of notorious example of African Americans essentially being used as guinea pigs is the Tuskegee syphilis trial, where African American men were, the treatment that would have saved their lives was withheld purely so researchers could see the progression of the disease. I mean, that's just one of the most unethical things you can possibly imagine, and yet went on relatively recently. Even among, you know, surgeons today, with the best will in the world, there is good, solid evidence that African Americans receive, for example, less pain medication. People trace this back to the idea that under slavery, the myth was, oh, African Americans feel less pain, and that's why it's okay to beat them or whip them occasionally, or work them harder than you would a white. And so these pervasive myths have ended up in situations where, with the best will in the world, and, you know, I think a lot of surgeons would say that they're not racist, and yet they're still prescribing less medication for pain for African Americans. So there's this very troubled history, and I think among the African American community, the result is a huge mistrust of the medical establishment, which then cuts two ways, because often African Americans don't want to sign up for clinical trials, and so medication isn't optimized for them. So it's a really pernicious and pervasive situation.
And this kind of complexity, too, that medical experimentation is necessary. It's given us so much, you know, through the years, could end up saving more lives. And in cases of gunshot wounds, let's look at, you know, Baltimore or Chicago, black lives. So how are the various sides approaching resolving this?
I mean, yeah, it's really, really difficult, because among the African-American folks that I spoke to in Baltimore, so many had lost sons and nephews to gun violence. Families would lose routinely two or three of a generation of black men. And there was a strong feeling that if these guys could have a second chance, I mean, and for many of them, they've never had a second chance at anything in life. You could argue they haven't really had a first chance. That giving them this second chance would be something that the people were strongly in favor of. And yet at the same time, you know, there we were, sat in the Mondawmin Mall, which is, you know, was the site of looting and riots after the Freddie Gray murder, essentially. And there's an African-American man coming up to the table and saying, you all are using us as guinea pigs. You don't even need to say anything. I know what's going on. And so there's very, very mixed responses. What the hospital has done is it has jumped through a lot of hoops to try to get out there and do these community consultations, be part of kind of gun violence conversations with folks. It says, and I found this to be true, that it does have a good relationship with the community. It's sort of right on the edge of West Baltimore there. So it is the community it serves, and it is sort of tied to that community. It's difficult. The surgeons themselves are very sensitive to this point. They want to do everything they can. They want to have all the tools they can have to save lives. But at the same time, there's no real way to say that this is informed consent, and so there's always an edge. One thing I think that is really interesting is a medical ethicist called Harriet Washington was talking to me. She's written a lot about experimentation on African Americans, and she said there's this thing called the therapeutic illusion, where surgeons are so sure and people are so sure that a radical new treatment, it could work, that they don't even see it as an experiment. They see it as a treatment. And I found, even while reporting this story, that I was falling into that hole. I was like, why wouldn't you do this? You have such poor chances otherwise. I mean, by the time you get to the stage where they will be doing EPR, you have like a 1 in 20 chance of making it anyway. You're going to die, pretty much. And so why wouldn't you want to try this? And Harriet pointed out, you know, that's the therapeutic illusion. You think this is going to be more effective than the existing standard of care because you have this sense of progress and medicine always moving forward, but actually it might not work. And then is it ethical? So I think there's just a lot of difficult questions about how we think about who to try these kinds of trauma surgeries on, because you can never get consent in the moment. So is it ethical to do them?
Nicola Twilley, she's co-host of the podcast Gastropod and a contributing writer for The New Yorker. Thank you so much for telling us about your reporting on this. That's an absolutely fascinating story.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And you'll find a link to read her New Yorker piece, Can Hypothermia Save Gunshot Victims?, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. An estimated 28,000 people died from opioid drug overdoses in 2014 alone. That's a 200% increase since the year 2000. While politicians, public health officials, and affected families grapple with the epidemic, it is professional caregivers who are increasingly on the front lines. Some of those doctors, hospital staff, addiction counselors, and emergency responders are also advocates for innovative, even radical approaches to treatment. Tim Leahy is a physician and ethicist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. He's also director of education at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. In an op-ed for the New York Times, Tim proposed that opioid users be allowed to inject while in hospital care. The article went viral and has drawn, as you can imagine, a wide variety of responses. Tim, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So, yes, tragic number of opioid deaths, as we all know. But what are some of the other health complications related to using that land people in the hospital and your care?
We've really had our hospital practice changed overnight by the opiate epidemic. Nowadays, every single day on the infectious diseases service at Dartmouth Hitchcock, we see young people who have serious infections as a result of their opiate abuse, infections of their heart valves, massive abscesses in muscles and in the soft tissues where they've injected. This went from being a relatively rare condition for us to treat to just garden variety medicine for us.
So the hospital becomes a detox, in effect. What does that mean for you and the hospital staff?
When somebody who spends most of every day injecting drugs is newly hospitalized with a lethal complication of that or just some other health problem, they typically have no intention of stopping their drug use. Occasionally, that is rock bottom, and we have a chance to get them into rehabilitation services. But most of the time, they continue to want to inject drugs, and so we have to grapple with that while we're caring for them in the hospital. So this means that oftentimes people will sneak drugs into their hospital room and, for instance, as in the case I described in the New York Times, try to inject heroin into their IV lines in the bathroom. They might stash used needles underneath the mattress, thereby endangering the housekeepers who try to change their linens. All manner of things like this will come up.
You suggest in your op-ed something that has been modeled in some municipalities, providing places for safe drug use. So you would do that in the hospital. How would that help?
This is an out-of-the-box idea that's forced by desperation. Many cities around the world, Vancouver, Paris, for instance, have erected outpatient facilities for people struggling with addiction in the community, where they can come and have a clean, well-lit place that has clean needles and a counselor there ready to give them access to rehabilitation services.
Our NHPR reporter, Paige Sutherland, she reported on consumption rooms in Germany, in Berlin, where addicts can use safely. Here's a clip of her talking with Christian Hennis, who works in one of these drug consumption rooms.
If people inject, somebody is sitting here and taken care. If somebody falls off the chair, we do this.
So that's Christian Hennis speaking to NHPR's Paige Sutherland. So, Tim, basically saying drug addicts are going to use no matter what, so let's just acknowledge it, make sure they do it hygienically and under the care of medical professionals. But this is a pretty radical rejection of just say no. Any U.S. hospitals actually considering it?
You're right that this is a radical rejection of just say no, because just say no just doesn't work. The reason for that is that we do our best to advise people struggling with addiction to get help and to get off drugs. We think that's important. We have lots of medical and psychiatric measures to support that. But the sad truth is that often they aren't ready for that and they insist on continuing to use. And so we are left to grapple with what to do with that. We could, as often happens in American hospitals, get into conflict with them, post a guard at the door, as happened in the story I put in the New York Times. Or we could try, as your clip suggested, to welcome them and to be open to them in ways that help them access needed services. I actually don't know of U.S. hospitals that have publicly come forward with established programs in doing this, but I know this is actively in conversation at many hospitals, including mine. And we're trying to figure out if this is the right out-of-the-box idea, knowing that there are some hospitals piloting this approach, and we're anxiously anticipating data coming out of them so that we can make the right step going forward.
The medical field and caregivers have had to adapt to the realities of life in contemporary America. You know, there are more cancer centers now, more specialties in different kind of diseases. What does this say about the future for the distinction between medical care and drug treatment? Is the wave of the future that hospitals will have to be active in addiction care?
This is a great question. You know, we have a specialty of addiction medicine, and I value the expertise that they bring to difficult problems like this. Increasingly, though, primary care physicians, hospital-based physicians, or specialists like me are having to grapple with the fact that addiction is part of everyday life for a growing segment of our society. So all of us have to have at least some facility dealing with this. For instance, I'm getting better and better at treating infections that happen from injection drug use. I think it's provoking change in our practice that we're trying to figure out how to deal with it, and it's not easy.
What is the calculation then for you as a physician and an ethicist? And in the idea of doing no harm, people who are using can overdose. They're perpetuating their addiction. I mean, they don't even allow smoking on the grounds of most hospitals. So how do you come up with the calculus of lesser of two evils? Is that it?
Yeah, that's exactly the right way to put it, Virginia. I've been asked this question exactly about whether we would allow smoking or drinking on campus and hospitals by a bunch of Twitter users and people who filled my inbox with their emails, most of them polite. And I think it's a great question. And the fact is that we don't allow smoking or alcohol use on our hospital campuses, in part because people who are addicted to those substances don't typically leave the hospital against medical advice in the middle of lethal illnesses in order to use their substance. They can hold on and accept our care. This is not the case with injection drug users, and so the calculus is truly different, and we're left to choose between an unusual way of allowing them to continue getting care in the hospital, or they exit and potentially die. These are the sons and daughters of our community, and I think we need to provide them with compassionate, open-minded care so that we save their lives and hopefully free them up for an opportunity in the future for rehabilitation.
Tim Leahy, a Dartmouth physician and ethicist. We spoke with him about his proposal, made in a New York Times op-ed, that addicts should be allowed to use, even inject drugs, while in hospital care. Tim, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Virginia.
You can find a link to read Tim's op-ed and some of the reactions to it. It really did cause quite a stir at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And now we visit the bookshelf with All Things Considered host Peter Biello, speaking today with novelist Jessica Estevo.
It's 1898, and 20-year-old Ruby Prue is working with her father in Canada. Their job? Sell medicines and other supposed cure-alls that don't work to people who don't know any better. She's a con artist, lured into that life by her father. When she and her father accidentally kill someone, they part ways. Ruby heads to Old Orchard, Maine, where her aunt runs a hotel that caters to mediums, psychics, and other folks who claim to see the future or communicate with the dead. That's the premise of the new novel by Milton Mills, New Hampshire author Jessica Estevan. It's called Whispers Beyond the Veil, and she joins me now to talk about it. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Let's talk about the setting of this book, Old Orchard Beach, just referred to as Old Orchard in this novel. Although, was it called Old Orchard Beach back in the day, 1898?
It was. It was called Old Orchard until, I think, the Depression, when they decided that they wanted to capitalize on the chief feature of the town, and they included beach in the name. So when this book is set in 1898, it was, in fact, called Old Orchard.
Gotcha. And I've been to Old Orchard within the past few years, and it seems like it's nothing like it was back then.
It's a town that's had a lot of reversals in fortune.
Yeah.
And it's, I think, a fairly classic sort of story where towns that were resort communities in the Victorian era, when everyone arrived on the train and many people stayed for the entire season, really fell on hard times when the motor car came into being. And people were interested in going off in all sorts of different directions to more scattered locations. And people weren't spending all season in a place with grand hotels. It's changed a lot over the years.
Mm-hmm. Seems like the pickpockets have cleared out somewhat.
I think the pickpockets are certainly not in force in the same way. It has its charms now that are different than they were then, but it's still a wonderful place to summer.
Certainly. So before we get into the details about Ruby Prue, tell us about what drew you to write about this particular era.
Well, I've always enjoyed things that were Victorian in nature. I grew up in a house full of antiques. There were lots of things that just had that feeling to them in my home. But I also wanted to tell a story about Old Orchard. That was really what I wanted to talk about. And I couldn't decide. You're spoiled for choice in that location. There are so many wonderful eras there. And since I was having trouble deciding, I thought, why not start where it all really began there, which was the year the pier opened. And that was 1898.
Mm-hmm. The year things may really have started to take off for the town.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There had been summer people there since the 1850s, when the train came down within 3 miles from Montreal in 1850. But it really didn't become nationally renowned until they decided to open the pier.
Mm-hmm. And so when Ruby appears in Old Orchard, having come from Canada to escape this murder that she was not really willing to be a part of, but her father sort of led her there, she's here now in Old Orchard, and she's encountering this almost convention of some would call them con men, others would call them people with special abilities to talk to the dead or know the future. Was this another feature of that era, a widespread belief that there were people who could see through to the other side and talk with the dead?
Absolutely. It was a very, very popular pastime to do table tipping and to hold seances. And in an era when there was no television and there was no radio, people sought a lot of entertainments at home, and this was one of them. People were either true believers or they weren't, but it was an interesting way to pass the time.
Mm-hmm. And Ruby, who, is it fair to call her a carny? Could you call her a carny?
I think that we would call her a carny now.
Yeah.
I'm not certain that they called them carnies at that point, but yes, I think that that would be a fair assessment.
Yeah, because she's got a good read on people. She can look at someone and sort of get a sense of where they're I don't want, maybe it's, maybe the right word is vulnerabilities, but she knows where she can sort of exploit something she's kind of learned from her father. And then when she goes to Old Orchard and she's staying at her aunt's hotel and there's a need for a medium, she's not really ever thought of herself in that way, but she's already got these skills because she considers herself a con artist.
Absolutely. She spent a lot of time doing medical intuitive work, which in her case is a complete con. She's able to read those micro gestures, that subtle leaning in, that subtle pulling away, the twitches in a face that say you're on track, you're off track. And she always wants to deliver news that people will want to hear because she is a good-hearted con artist. And so she ends up using those for good, not evil, I suppose, in what she delivers for messages. But she's absolutely a con artist. She's absolutely got a skill set for reading people that she's honed over a lot of years. And it works wonders for her when she arrives at Old Orchard.
Yeah, and one of the strengths of the narrative, I think, is that you are able to paint a portrait of a character who does these things that are less than above board, and you still like her. You still appreciate who she is.
I love to hear that because I really like her, and I hope that readers like her too. I think one of the ways that that's accomplished is her honesty with herself about who she is and the fact that she shares with the reader her struggle about her conscience with things. And she really does try to use what she's able to see generally to help people, not usually to extract more money from them or to put herself in a position of power over them. She usually does it to push them along a path they wanted to go along anyway. Or, as she likes to think about it, people generally make their own destiny based on their beliefs. And so she likes to help reinforce beliefs that will take them to the destiny that's better for them anyway. So I think she is pretty likable, even though she has a kind of a grotty job.
Yeah. Well, you get the sense that under different circumstances, if she had a choice, she wouldn't have chosen this line of work.
I do not think she would have chosen any part of her life before she reached Old Orchard, no.
Right. She was sort of dealt this silly hand. But as with any hand you're dealt, your fortunes can change. And that's why this is called a change of fortunes mystery.
Yes.
The first of a series, I should mention, that there's more to come for Ruby.
That's correct.
Well, Jessica, thank you very much for speaking to me about your book.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Jessica Estevo there, author of Whispers Beyond the Veil. And that's this week's installment of The Bookshelf. It's a series of conversations with All Things Considered host Peter Biello and writers who are from or fixated on the Granite State. You can hear the entire series on iTunes or Google Play. Thank you for spending some time with us today. Music in this episode came from Blue Dot Sessions, Broke for Free, and David Seste. There is tons more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And we invite you to listen on your own schedule with the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search Word of Mouth NHBR in iTunes or Google Play. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow too with more Word of Mouth here on NHBR.